Hello and welcome to the September episode of the Organic Gardening Podcast. I'm Fiona Taylor, and in a moment I'll be joined by Chris Collins and Dr. Anton Rosenfeld. This month we're in the thick of the harvest. Our Heritage Seed Library team are up to their ears in tomatoes, preparing to save the seed to distribute to our members later this year. And we've been pulling up reams of carrots from our organic demonstration garden. Later on, Chris will be getting to grips with green manures, as Anton explains how sowing these plants can be central to looking after your soil. And we'll be answering your questions on what type of sand you can use in the garden, when not to harvest rhubarb, and what to do when your potato plants result in no yield whatsoever. But now it's time to catch up with Chris in the potting shed. Hello, Chris. How are you?
I'm good, Fiona. How are you?
Yeah, very well, yeah. Thank you. Lovely summer. I had two glorious weeks off.
Did you enjoy nice and relaxed?
Yeah, really relaxed. I stayed at home, didn't do nearly enough gardening, but at the same time, just enjoyed being being in my garden and seeing this year has just been such a good year for insects, hasn't it? I just feel like there's been a resurgence.
It has. Maybe they've enjoyed the summer, maybe, but I've certainly butterflies. I've been a really bumper year for them. I've been quite concerned by their absence in recent years.
Yes.
There seem to be a lot more of them this year. And obviously they're a real treat to see, and they do an important job in the garden.
They do, and I've found this year that I've had so many that I've actually started to identify them. I mean, you know, I know the obvious ones, but not necessarily the others. So I never knew what a comma looked like until this year. I now know what a comma looks like. And I was at a wonderful growing partner of ours, Nanty Beth Garden, just out in Wales, and a really, really gorgeous organic garden, well worth a visit. But they showed us round, and it was a lovely sunny afternoon, and, you know, true to form, on a buddleia, there must have been 40 butterflies.
Yeah.
I mean, it was absolutely extraordinary. We were all, you know, sort of open mouths watching this, because I have got a buddleia, of course, in my garden. But this year, the butterflies don't seem to have gone for it. I've seen butterflies around my pond.
Yeah, really. Mm. There's something there that's attracting them. It's interesting you should mention buddleia, because obviously it's not a native. It comes from China originally, and it shows how these plants can imbibe into our gardens as well, even though they come from, not necessarily from this country. So you can plant. Gardens tend to be criticised because we plant stuff from maybe not native, but actually a lot of plants can attract wildlife as well. That's worth noting, really.
It is worth noting, yeah. But it's interesting. I wonder if it's something to do with being in a town that for some reason my buddleia isn't that attractive.
Maybe.
The countryside where I was seeing our growing partner at Nanty Beth, that was really in the heart of woodland and the, you know, sort of forest around us.
Maybe a greater population of butterfly, maybe.
But you don't half wonder if they're a bit thirsty. I mean, I did have an amazing dragonfly hatch in my pond. That's just been extraordinary. I've seen, you know, I've had four or five chrysalises, so I've seen, you know, what they've left behind. But actually, at one stage, I saw one hatch in front of me, and a great big emperor dragonfly.
Yeah, brilliant. They're big creatures. You don't
yes.
say, when you see them close up. I see them a lot when I fish, and they're quite impressive.
Yeah. So it does seem, certainly the butterflies and dragonflies and moths that we've noticed. I saw an amazing hummingbird moth. It's just very heartening, because after last year when we really thought, oh crikey, have we got a major ongoing problem here? And I'm sure there's plenty of room for plenty more insects, and we need to see a reduction in the use of pesticides, and we need to see people, you know, supporting nature in their gardens more and more. We've got to do what we can to support them, but at least there seems to be something more to support now.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what the reasons for the insurgence is, isn't it? I was talking to our friend Dave Goulson, obviously, is the big insect manager. He said there's been much bigger numbers this year than there has been in previous years, so we need to look at that, I think.
Yeah. I mean, September is the time where we get the results of the big butterfly count. It'd be really interesting to see if our perceptions are true.
Yeah, it will be. Yeah, it really will. Because you never know, we might be looking, we've spotted a few, so we're looking a bit more closely than we normally do.
I've been encouraged to see a few more wasps this year as well.
Yes, it's funny because I said about 2 months ago, I've never seen wasps much anymore, and suddenly they just seem to be everywhere. Yeah. Certainly, when I'm fishing, I saw a load last weekend, and if you're obviously sitting outside with a pint of cider, they turn up pretty promptly.
Yes, they do. Exactly. Yeah. I think they're quite partial to ginger beer, I've discovered as well.
There's a lot of them in the orchard I work in. Obviously, as the apples are dropping, that's bringing them in as well. And I like wasps. I know the only way to get stung by one if you're careless, really. They might buzz around you, but they'll move on in their own time, you know. So
the thing that I've really noticed, being a miracle in our garden this year, is I've had an extraordinary harvest of figs from our fig tree. We're talking 200-300 figs. It's just gone berserk.
Well, they're expensive to buy at the shop. You get like a quid for four of them. If they're ripe, they are unbelievable. My favourite fruit, if they're good, you know.
It's not just the figs that have done well. I mean, I've got neighbours bringing me boxes of plums. I've had an absolute bumper harvest of apples.
Yeah.
Have you noticed it's been amazing?
It's been incredible, yeah. Mirabilis, you know, the little yellow plum. I'm absolutely covered in fruit, damsons as well, and it's been a brilliant year. I'm not sure why, but it must just be the heat in early spring, maybe early summer, that's really brought it on. Active pollinators, but I've got apple trees in the orchard I look after that are dripping with it, you know, really like literally sagging under the weight of apple.
Yeah,
it's hard to know what to do with them all, really.
It must have been that around the blossom time we obviously had a period without frost.
She had a mild spring, and the ones I look after, I prune them, I winter prune them, and I gave them quite a big feed of well-rotted horse manure, and I think that bumped them on a bit. But there, you might. The main reason is there was no late frost to get the flower to drop, so it's been a bumpy year, and you just got to figure out ways to use them, haven't we?
I've got quite creative, and there's some plum vulca on the go.
Yeah, very good. I like the sound of that.
3 month gestation period.
Yeah.
For that. So just in time for Christmas, I've frozen a load of them. The figs, you have to cook them. They don't freeze terribly well. Yeah. You have to cook them into something. So I've done, you know, compote and jams. And I've also kind of just sort of stewed them. So I've got a base for a crumble. I can mix them with some other fruit for crumble. And apparently figs go a bomb in mincemeat. So if I get my act together and make some Christmas mincemeat.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
Some figs into it. But
certainly lucky to have fig because they're just such a delicious fruit. They
amazing.
Really are.
Yeah. But great for chutney and things like that. But actually what we've really enjoyed more than anything is just taking bowls and bowls of them around to our neighbours.
A bit of camaraderie with fruit.
Yeah, definitely. It's lovely, isn't it, to bring people together around a harvest?
Yes, certainly is. Yeah. It's a special time, I think.
Yeah. And what about the veg patch? How's your harvest going there?
It's just really gone for it. I'm taking a lot of food off it at the moment. Lots of squash, lots of pumpkin. Been an unbelievable year for tomato. I've done more tomato than I know what to do with. Of course, I grew quite a lot of varieties. So it's just incredible just seeing all the different colours and shapes.
Yes.
But there's a lot of them. There's a lot of sauce making going on in the house.
Yes.
And runner beans have been all right. I've been cropping those as well. Basically, I'm taking home two bags of veg, really, probably every other day off the allotment.
And if people are still harvesting, any top tips around how to harvest well?
Yeah, certainly. I think the big thing with it is I think it's easy to start tearing at your veg when you're collecting it, you know. I think people, you can damage the plants quite easy. You really, the season isn't over yet, so you want them maybe to fruit a little bit more. So if you're careful, things like runner beans, it's easy to tug at them and pull them away. I would use a pair of snippers. Make sure you cut them to the bottom of the petiole so you're not leaving any dieback on the plant, and then hopefully they can maybe reflower. Time of day is quite important. I always crop early in the morning. Plants are turgid usually, so they're quite strong and turgid, so that's a good time to take them and not flagging like they might be later on in the afternoon. Things like courgettes and pumpkins and squashes, I've done a very gentle turn to the right so they snap away nice and clean. Some gardeners would prefer to use secateurs and make it an even cleaner cut, but my main rule is just to take your time. Sometimes I've gone down there with the angel weed and do stuff and sow, and I'll end up just harvesting for 2 hours. It's quite a big job in its own right.
Yeah.
So just take your time and make sure you harvest properly and that you'll get good crop.
So while you've got your secateurs out and you've finished your harvesting, is there anything that could do with a quick prune at this time of year?
Yeah, I think herbs are pretty good. Yeah. Late summer, they've all flowered. Say like your lavender. If you haven't looked at it for the moment, it'll have all those dead flower heads on.
Yes.
And obviously lavenders naturally want to become woody and collapse and colonise their land that way. If you see them in places like Spain where they're native, they tend to spread out and be quite
woody. Yes, yes.
You want to stop that, so you take out the apex. So you basically take off the flower head, take off maybe 2 centimetres of the foliage as well. So you give them a haircut. I probably do the same with things like rosemary as well. Mm. Even you'll find that quite this time of year, maybe things like lemon balm and mint start to look a bit mouldy and mildewy. You can give them a haircut as well. Mm. But certainly that's what I'll be. They'll be. It's still late summer, so you can still, it's not too early for most pruning, but those are the things you can look at.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So too early to worry about the rest of the garden. But yeah, I mean, I just think it's you kind of want to give them a bit of a pat on the back, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, it's a sort of thanks for everything you've done.
Yeah. So, well, it's certainly, I mean, this year particularly, I mean, I've been up at 5:30 in the morning down that allotment watering.
Yeah.
Because it's just been so dry. And then you're off to do your day's work. But I really feel that it's worth it. I really do. You know, and we've been having some good dinners at home as a result.
Oh, I know. And there's just nothing like it, is it? You know, it's something you've grown yourself and eat the same day. You know, it's just absolutely magic. It really is. Even though it's still late summer and, you know, we're still enjoying this year and this season, it's kind of a good time to perhaps start thinking about next year.
Yeah.
And are there any things that you could get a bit of a march on if you were going to do some sowing now?
Well, I think in terms of ornamental, lots of people like to sow their hardy annuals in the autumn and overwinter them. I prefer to do mine early spring, but I think it's either or, really. I think both is possible. So that's obviously your cornflowers, your poppies, that kind of stuff, those hardy annuals. But also biannuals, remember, this is quite important. So I started them, you can start them August, September. So things like digitalis, the foxglove, hollyhocks, those sort of second season flowers.
I've got the pods on right now, so that's the clue,
I'm an avid seed collector, as you know. So I'm out collecting those plants now. I'm out, so ready for next year's. To sow now for next year's flowers.
Yes.
So this is quite an exciting time to do it. I'm a nightmare, really. I have a seed sowing collection kit wherever I go, and so my local park gets raided. And
Yeah.
So that's the nature of the game, isn't it?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think also, you know, they're there to be used. I mean, seed is meant to be sown, and you know, the idea that plants might get sort of taken out and they haven't had the chance to set their own seed, you know, you kind of feel like you're doing the plant a favor, really.
Yeah, you are. You're helping along the way. Certainly.
In terms of veg crops, anything that you might be doing over the winter, you know, I've got a greenhouse, as you know, just anything I could be beginning to think about over the winter.
Yeah, certainly. Well, I mean, if you've got cover, that helps a lot. So I have a polytunnel I work in, and I notice that definitely gives me an extended season. Mm. So all those sort of leafy crops, the spinach, the rockets, the cucumber and salad, I sow a big load of those for August and September because they'll roll into the winter for me and I can use them. So that's certainly possible. Things like turnips and swedes and stuff, I like to sow them now. So you get, even if I don't use them till the following year, I like to get them up and running. Mm. They can be quite quick if the conditions are right as well. So you might, if you're lucky, have some in the pot for Christmas, you know, if you're lucky. So there is stuff you can still sow. It's not time to stop yet, but have a little look. If you've got, like you say, a greenhouse or a polytunnel, then remember you've got that extended season.
Yeah, absolutely. So you got going with your seeds for next year and thinking about your biennials as well. What kind of plans are coming into your head for growing for next year?
Well, it's interesting you ask me, because I work at an Outward Bound centre, which is for kids from the East End. And obviously the kids from the East End tend to be from all over the world by descent. So I thought I'd take a leaf out of Anselm's book, to be honest with you, who did all the research on more unusual crops in the UK. He obviously visited a lot of the allotments and what people have come here in the 50s and 60s are growing. I find all this fascinating. So I'm going to do some more. I'm going to be a bit more adventurous next year.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to try some unusual stuff. And I'll be taking the lead from Anselm's research, I think. Mm. So a chop future, maybe. I think okra I'd like to try.
Oh, yeah. I've never grown that. Yeah, no. I don't know what the plant looks like.
Well, it's kind of a small little plant, isn't it?
Okay.
So, yeah, yeah. So I think almost it can... I know they just, you always see it in Japan growing in people's front gardens. They always have a little plot and it's sort of there as well.
Okay.
I think I might try some wasabi. I've got a kind of a damp area in the back of the allotment, which must be a clay band underneath.
Okay, so hang on. Tell me what a wasabi plant looks like.
Well, it's got a long, thin, lanceolate leaves. Quite a big plant.
Okay.
Yeah, and it likes its feet wet, so it's good for an area that's really, really soaking, basically.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So, yeah, yeah. So there's a few things there. I mean, this is going to be new territory for me in many ways.
Okay.
But I think that's quite a nice thing to do, because hopefully if, say, a child originates from Bangladesh or something like that, hopefully if I can grow a crop, there's a narrative there.
Yeah.
And I just think it's a way of engaging people,
yes.
You know.
Yeah.
We'll do some good old-fashioned spuds as well, that are maybe our heritage varieties, and so we'll make it as, you know, as varied as possible.
Yeah. Well, I had huge success this year with amaranth. It's been an absolute joy. I mean, partly, I think, because it was such a hot summer. But, you know, talk about a plant that totally performs, that you have to do absolutely nothing to. I mean, I scattered the seed. That was it.
Yeah, yeah. You
know? And it's tiny, tiny seed. You know, it's like sand, really. Tiny, tiny seed. Pink was the seed of the variety I was sowing. And, you know, it's just grown so tall. It's probably, I don't know, it's probably a metre and a quarter.
Yeah, so, good, yeah. They're self-seed as well.
Self-seed. I mean, people have said, you know, are you sure?
Yeah.
With amaranth? But of course, it's so easy. You just pick it and steam it.
Yep.
It's not one of those crops that's fussy. You can just chuck it into things.
Yeah, sure.
You know, you can chuck it into a curry. You can chuck it into scrambled eggs. You can just steam up a load and you've got spinach type veg on the side. And if you're a huge fan of leafy crops, which I am, then I just can't recommend it high enough. I just absolutely love it. Now, apparently there's clever things you can also do from a culinary perspective with the seeds and the flowers. I've not done that. I need to do a little bit more research.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do think the broadening out into crops that do better in these hotter summers. I mean, of course, we've no idea what summer we're going to get, but you know, the impression is that the humidity might be higher, or the general climate might be higher, you know, and amaranth is one of those crops that will really reward you.
Well, so we're definitely looking at hotter summers, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
That's for sure. And I think that compromises a little bit those traditional lettuces and rockets, which just tend to bolt in the heat. So we have to start, again, I've always said it, you spread your bets. I won't stop sowing rocket. I might change the time of year I do it, but it's nice to try new things and see how they adapt and what's happening.
Yeah, yeah. What do you feel about September, though, Chris, as a month? I love it.
I do. I mean, it's not, summer's not over. You see a lot of stuff, right? Social media going, August come in and calm down. You know, it's still summer. It's still summer. I think we're going to have a quite an early autumn. In fact, I'm looking out the window now. I can see a little bit of dapples of yellow in an ash tree there. And I think basically the plants have had a hard year, particularly the trees.
Exhausting for the trees.
And the shrubs. Yeah. And so you might find that sets it a little earlier, but I think September is usually a beautiful month, as is the first few weeks in October. So I love that time of harvesting. I love that time of all the effort you've put in through the year. And I did put in a lot of effort and your harvesting and stuff. It's a very, very beautiful month. I definitely am.
Yeah. Yeah. And no, I agree. I think it's a lovely month because there's still time. That's what I love about September. There is still time to sow some things. You know, we've talked about that. You can still be enjoying the harvests through September. You know, you can sit outside and have a cup of tea in September.
Yes, it's not too cold yet.
It's just not. And then October, it's interesting because sometimes it turns overnight, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it'd be interesting to see when that first cold night hits.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot going on in the garden still. The roses will still be flowering. There's proboscis and sedums and all these other plants that are still there giving out flower and colour. You know, the rebeccias. There's lots of stuff still going on. Exinias will still be going. So it's a long way from the dark months yet.
It is. And it's well worth going and having a poke around some other people's gardens as well. I mean, you know, I mentioned before that we've got a new scheme called Growing Partners here, Garden Organic. So people have put forward their gardens to show people how to grow fruit and veg, but also how to be an organic garden and how to kind of go with your garden.
Yeah,
you know, go with the plants, go with nature, go with the seasons, you know, allow the space for the wildlife, allow the systems to do their thing, you know, the natural systems. And so I'm looking forward to having a look around a few gardens, you know, through the autumn. But of course, there's this kind of myth, I think, that we perhaps all ought to put our garden to bed properly, you know, in the autumn. But actually, there's a few jobs to do, but generally, you kind of need to let nature take its course, don't you?
Yeah, I think a lot's still going on. It just changes its character, you know.
Yeah.
You'll find me on my allotment in the dead of winter still, I promise you. So I think you're right. There's always something going on, and you can plan for it as well. There's a lot of really colourful shrubs, centre shrubs, sarcococcus and stuff like daffodils.
Yes.
They were brilliant in the winter. So if you're planned properly, you can keep stuff rolling over, and that's the idea. If you are putting stuff in, you know, like turnips and swedes or winter potatoes for Christmas Day, so there's actually activity going on there as well. So there's always something to be getting on with.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you've got soil health. You should be looking at your green manures, maybe turning your compost if you're hot compostings,
yeah.
You know, making sure it gets mixed up properly, get the air and the moisture into it. So there's always, you're never without a job. You really aren't.
Yeah. And there's things like, you know, planning ahead and seeing if you can increase the number of water butts in your garden for next year and, you know, fixing things up if you've got, you know, a leaky shed or if you've got, you know, a greenhouse that needs a bit of attention. I suppose there's time to think about those sort of edges
yes.
of the garden.
Yes, the jobs I don't have time to do in the summer.
Yeah.
Because I'm too busy. I'm going to pimp my shed, definitely. That's one thing I'll do because, you know, I love my shed.
Yes.
So I'm going to decorate that. And just little jobs like that are just good fun. And I will do them when I've got the time to do them, basically.
Yes, yeah, exactly, because there aren't so many other jobs. Well, it's a good month, isn't it, September? I feel like it gives us all a bit of a second chance.
Yes, I think so. I really enjoy it. And you get, like you say, it's still warm. You can still kick about in a T-shirt. That's good enough for me.
Now, this month, Chris spoke to Dr. Anton Rosenfeld, research manager here at Garden Organic. Anton is a regular on the podcast, providing answers to all of your gardening questions. The one topic that comes up time and time again is that of green manures, when you sow plants that will improve your soil rather than spreading compost on top of it. A great solution if you haven't got enough homemade compost. But first, Chris asked Anton to explain to us the purpose of green manures.
So, a green manure is actually a plant that's grown to improve the soil. It's really grown to sort of give the soil a boost and recharge it. So it's actually nothing to do with manure or cow muck or anything like that, despite its names.
But you are using it as a fertilizer. And how does that differ from traditional fertilizers and composts?
In quite a lot of ways. I mean, you are putting the land to rest for a bit, really, which is what we always used to do traditionally. Used to give the land a bit of a break, because obviously when you're growing vegetables, you're sort of really hammering the land, really. You're taking a lot of nutrients out of it, and those need to be put back at some time to give the ground a bit of a break. So in terms of the difference, you really need a bit more planning, I think. You need to, think when you're going to grow them. You need to obviously have some seed as well. You just not sort of suddenly think, oh, I'm going to put green manures on this day. Yeah, they take a little bit of getting used to and seeing what works on your site as well.
So I suppose, you know, I mean, I remember in the younger days we used to do, you have lays, farmers would have a lay field where you'd plant clover and it would fix a notch. And then, so you're, like you're saying, you're giving it a rest. So are you primarily looking at areas that become gapped in your growing? So if something opens up, especially later in the season, you'll be then looking to sow a green manure?
Yeah, it's really looking at any sort of opportunity to try and avoid having bare soil, really. Bare soil is sort of wasted space. And I mean, obviously, in a small garden where you're growing veg, then all the land is sort of at a premium. And so people perhaps are less sort of inclined to, oh, I don't want to put that bit aside there because I want to be growing veg on it. But actually, if you value the whole of your sort of cropping system, then that investment of growing a green manure is actually worth it in the long run.
Why are they so valuable to organic gardeners? Or is it a natural connection? Is it a natural affiliation?
Green manures, you're actually building soil fertility, but you're using things on site. It's like a sort of closed loop system. You're actually generating your fertility within the system. You're not bringing anything from outside. So I think that's why it really sort of ties in with the organics so well, because it's a really sort of sustainable way of building the soil.
So it's like an independent form of gardening in a way. You're not bringing stuff in from other places, other countries, other shops or whatever. You're doing it internally.
Yeah, I always think that's a good measure of your sustainability in your garden is sort of how much stuff am I actually having to bring in? How much stuff am I having to buy? And with green manures, you're just buying a small packet of seeds. So really, it sort of scores really well on that front. And also, for organic gardeners, the benefits are really numerous as well. Not only are you benefiting your soil fertility, but there's lots of other benefits, like you're sort of increasing the biodiversity. A lot of green manures will flower as well, so they're bringing in sort of insects and pollinators as well. So the benefits are really very numerous.
So soil health is obviously key. So it's helping. I mean, there's obviously problems if you've got open ground, then you have problems with leaching and nutrients washing through, and generally heavy rains might degrade. So you're using the green manures to protect the soil. How else does it contribute to soil health?
So there's loads of ways that green manures contribute to soil health. One of the main things is they're adding a lot of organic matter to the soil. Organic matter is really key to soil health. In layman's terms, organic matter is just sort of dead leaf materials, simply. And what it does is it acts like a sponge. And so what that does is it helps the soil to hold on to moisture better, but it also helps it to drain better. So it sort of works in both ways. Having that organic matter also acts as a sort of food for soil life. And the more life we can get in the soil, the more it's going to help those plants. A dead soil is, you know, those plants are working in isolation. They're really struggling, living a really sort of lonely existence. So all that soil life is really important. You've got lots of different sort of sizes of soil life, which all help to make different sort of channels in the soil, you know, right down from sort of fungi and bacteria, right the way up to sort of worms and millipedes and wood lice. They're all making those channels and helping to cultivate the soil for you, saving you a job. So by feeding them, you're really sort of helping to maintain the health of your soil. Also, they protect the soil surface as well. So if you've leaving a soil bare over winter is really bad news for quite a number of reasons. For a start, it tends to wash out a lot of the nutrients that you've added to the soil. So not only are you losing those nutrients, but they are also ending up in our groundwater as well. So that's sort of doubly bad. But by having a green manure growing there, you are actually taking up those nutrients and preserving them and making sure they're not lost from the system. And then they're ready for the plants to use in the spring. Also, they protect the surface of the soil. So again, leaving a bare soil, if you've got a really sort of wet winter, which we always seem to have now, the rain pounding on the surface of the soil tends to glue the particles together. And then what happens is in the summer, that bakes hard like concrete. So you've then got a soil which really won't absorb moisture very well. So in terms of planning for drought tolerance later on, it's really important. And then lastly, you've got the actual roots as well of the green manure. They're helping to break up all those sort of hard, cloddy, panny bits in the soil. So they're helping to do the cultivation for you. Quite a few green manures are legumes, and so they are essentially fertilizing your soil for free. What they do is they take nitrogen from the air. They've got bacteria in their roots which fix nitrogen from the air and turn it into a form that the plants can use, because there's plenty of nitrogen around. It's all in the air, but that's as a gas which obviously the plants can't use, but those bacteria actually convert that gas into a soluble form as a fertilizer that the plants can take up as a sort of nitrogen fertilizer.
So really they are, I mean, the multiple levels of benefits are quite incredible, aren't they? They really are absolutely essential in some ways to an organic gardener, but all gardeners, I'd argue. So with another layer of vegetation, the big question I suppose for some people might have is, what kind of plants would I use as a green manure?
Yeah, so this can often be really confusing for people because there just seem to be so many different types of green manure to start off with, and people just, it's like kids in a sweet shop, really. They don't know which one to choose. I often think the best place to start is really thinking, how long is it going to be there? And then you can sort of think, am I going to use a short-term green manure or a long-term green manure? So the short-term green manures, I can give some examples of those. So I'd say Phacelia is a really good one. It's
great for bees as well.
It is, yeah. It's like catnip for bees. Yeah. I think they go absolutely crazy for it. But yeah, that's a good one to start with, I think, because it's quite easy to germinate, and also it breaks down quite easily as well. It doesn't become really, really tough. So that's a good one. So vetch is a really good one because, again, it's easy to get it established. It grows quite vigorously. So if you've got a weedy soil, it will outcompete those. But vetch is also a legume, so it will fix nitrogen really well. So when you dig it back in, it will release that nitrogen for the next plants. Also, as a short-term green manure, you can use grazing rye over the winter. You only want to use grazing rye over the winter. Grazing rye is basically, it is like the cereal that we grow for making rye for bread, but you grow it over the winter, and then what it does is it basically just takes up all the nitrogen and stops it being leached out. So that's a really good one. You have to just be a little bit careful that you don't leave it in too long. Otherwise, it does get really, really tough.
I was going to ask maybe if some of these plants are perennials, then obviously digging them in, et cetera, would have to happen before they set seed. That's worth keeping an eye on, is it?
Yeah. So all the ones I've mentioned so far are annuals. And yeah, you do want to make sure that they don't set seed unless you want them to come back again next year. I mean, I can think of worse weeds to occur. There's also crimson clover. I think that's a really good one as well, for a sort of shortish period of time, just because it has a really sort of spectacular array of flowers. It looks really, really good. If you've got stuff that's growing for slightly longer, you might, like you say, go for a perennial. So some of the perennials are red clover, white clover are perennials, and they will last several years. If you just happen to have a patch that you're not doing anything with, then that's a good use of those. I found clovers, actually, they're a little bit more tricky to get established. They're not as competitive, but one of the real tricks with them, and this might seem really counterintuitive, is to actually cut them down and mow them at an early stage, and that gets rid of all the weeds, but it makes the clover come back a lot more vigorously. That's what farmers always do. They mow their clovers, because you don't want to be hand weeding clover. People have got better things to do. The other types of green manures which I think are useful are ones which you can sow underneath crops. So those want to be ones which aren't very vigorous, that don't compete against the crops. So I find yellow trefoil or a small leafed white clover are really useful for that, just because they're not so likely to take over the crop.
So you can almost use them as a ground cover then for larger crops.
Yeah, particularly with taller crops. I think it works really well for things like French beans, climbing beans. Just sow some green manures underneath them, and then when you take the beans out, you've already got a green manure there ready and waiting. I find with growing green manures mixed with some other crops, things like cabbages, it's quite a tricky balance. Oh. Sometimes the green manure does a little bit too well and might actually sort of compete against the cabbages, in which case you'd have to sort of cut them back a bit.
So I suppose a big question might be for people is when the best time to do this? You're just talking about underplanting there. Would that be earlier in the season, or and then maybe later in the season you'd be sowing green manures as soil becomes exposed?
So I think you have to perhaps think about what the green manure needs to germinate to start off with. And it needs basically, like any seed, it needs warmth and moisture. So there's always plenty of warmth throughout the summer. So any time from about March, April onwards is fine to sow a green manure. So the other challenge is moisture. And obviously, with the summer that we've just had, if you're sowing a green manure, it can really be quite a challenge to just water it enough to get it going. Once it's got going, they don't need too much moisture, but that often can be a bit of a challenge. I think it's useful to sort of roll the soil a bit or sort of firm it up with a rake as well.
Like a consolidation. It's like if you were laying a lawn by seed, you'd do similar treatment.
Exactly, yeah. Often people sow green manures sort of late summer just to get them in after their veg and protect the soil for the winter. That's as good a time as any, but it's just making sure you do it early enough. I think once you get past about the sort of first or second week of September, the soil temperatures tend to dip and then you're sort of establishment isn't so good, or sometimes they just don't have long enough to get big enough.
Established.
Yeah.
So I suppose, yeah, because the day length starts to decrease and the nights get cooler and that makes it more tricky.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you find it has germinated, but it's just piddly little plants, which aren't actually doing much good to protect the soil. So, yeah, you want really, I'd say if you can get it in sort of middle of August, really. Often people have this big challenge that they're still harvesting veg and they don't want to rip their veg out just to plant a green manure. So I think the undersowing thing is a really useful thing. So just to elaborate what that means, but if you are growing particularly a tall crop like French beans, climbing French beans, runner beans, at the same time as you plant out your beans, sow those green manures underneath them. They will remain really quite small underneath your crop of beans. But when you come to take down your bean poles or whatever in October, you've already got a green manure there ready and waiting. Whereas if you tried to sow it in October, it just wouldn't germinate.
Yeah, sure. It's a really good idea. So you're preempting in a way, aren't you?
Yeah, it does require a bit of forward planning because most people are too excited about planting their beans out to think about having the green manure afterwards. But if you can plan forward like that, it's a really good way of doing it.
So, Anton, what are the general basics of growing and incorporating a green manure crop?
So I guess the first thing is getting good establishment. So that depends. You've got to be a bit careful about your seed size. So the smaller things like the clover seeds are really quite small seeds. So you just want to make sure you don't sow them too deep, but mainly just firming up the soil to make sure that that sort of soil makes good contact with the seed. The larger ones can, things like vetch and field beans, they can go a little bit deeper. And yeah, just again, keeping them moist as well so that you get good germination. With the clovers, like I said, you can actually cut them back a bit too, and that can help with the weeding. So that works really well. It means that the clover sort of grows back more vigorously than the weeds. And then after that, really, it's a question of incorporating it at the right time. So some green manures, particularly the annual ones, after they flowered, they start to get really tough. And so you want to make sure that you incorporate them at the right time. So what I tend to do is you can cut them down. And then if you dig, you can dig them in. If you're in a no-dig system, then what I tend to do is something that people call chop and drop. So you chop it down, let it fall onto the soil, and I put a layer of compost on the top to help it to break down. And that seems to work pretty well for me. If you do happen to let it get really, really tough and horrible, it might be better just to put it on your compost heap and then you're then getting that fertility back at a slightly later time.
Yeah, I think the first time I grew mustard as a green manure, I left it too late and it was too pithy and it just sat there and did nothing. So it ended up. So timing's quite important with that then.
It is, yeah. And I think that one of the things is that they really say that you ought to cut them back before flowering, but with things like crimson clover and Persian clover, they look so pretty that you don't want to do
and
that.
And obviously the pollinators love them as well.
Yeah. So it's that sort of balance, really. I find that you can let them flower a bit, really, and still incorporate them and get some goodness out.
Are there any other mistakes gardeners might make that they should be aware of when they're sowing green manures?
I think the main one really is just making sure they don't get too woody. The grazing rye is actually one of the sort of real pains if you let it, if you leave it too long, because it starts to form a cereal head and you've just got this massive sort of straw almost that will just take a long, long time to break down. The other thing to bear in mind as well is some green manures have an allelopathic effect. In English, that basically means that they stop other plants germinating for about 3 or 4 weeks after they've been incorporated. Mm. So grazing rye and vetch are particularly bad for that.
So they release a chemical to subdue other plants, basically?
They do, yeah. It's their own sort of form of biological warfare. So make sure that they sort of have rule the roost. So it's, yeah, that you just need to bear that in mind to leave a long enough gap before you sort of sow anything directly.
Right. And very interesting. So on a broader impact, how do green manures fit into sustainable gardening and reduce reliance, say, on inputs?
Well, yeah, they really do. I mean, they were used extensively in farming for hundreds and hundreds of years. Like there's records of the Romans using them. It's only when we invented nitrogen fertilizer, when it really came to be used on a big scale in the 50s and 60s, that they really got dropped. And so by not having to use nitrogen fertilizer, you are having a massive sort of reduction in your carbon footprint, because the production of nitrogen fertilizer it basically uses a lot of fossil fuels to make it. It's the actual production of nitrogen fertilizer is a really energy intensive process, and so this input is actually the thing that has the biggest environmental sort of footprint in terms of agriculture and food production. It's really quite huge. So if you can sort of phase that out and basically got these plants making nitrogen for free, then that really does reduce the carbon footprint within your garden. You need to make sure that you've got all your sort of ducks in a row. One of the common things that organic growers do is to use green waste compost or some sort of compost in conjunction with a green manure. So the reason they do that is the green manure releases a lot of nitrogen, and the compost is generally rich in readily available potassium and phosphorus. So the two used in combination work really well to provide those sort of three main nutrients that the plant needs.
Are there any other myths that drive you mad out there about green manures? Any myths you want to bust about them?
I think you get quite a few from no-dig growers, because a lot of the early sort of manuals on using green manure say dig them in, and then when people are sort of wedded to the no-dig philosophy, then they see the word dig in there and hold up their hands in horror. But actually they can be used in no-dig systems. I think the thing is to make sure that you're using a green manure that doesn't get too tough.
Chop and drop.
Yeah.
Let's just finish on this then. For someone who's never tried green manures before, what's the best first step?
Well, obviously the first step is to get some seed, because you do have to think in advance. It's not like just chucking something on the soil. So it's deciding how long it's going to be there for. And for most people in the garden, perhaps just go for one that's going to be there for a short term, and I'd probably go for Phacelia. It's a really easy one.
It's a beautiful plant as well.
I guess the first step is try and avoid leaving your soil bare over winter. If that's one thing you can do with a green manure, that's
so it's almost like a mentality, no bare soil. If you can get that round your head first, then and that's your step one,
definitely. Yeah.
Anton, always an absolute mind of information, and I've worked with you for a few years now, and this is one of the subjects I've certainly taken on board and used in my own practices. If you wanted to find out more about all of this, the resources at Garden Organic we can home in on?
Yeah, we've got quite a lot on our website. We've got quite a few sort of fact sheets and things on green manures. Also, a while ago, we wrote a little sort of booklet on green manure. It's more farming scale, but it's got a lot of information in there, and it's called Sort Out Your Soil. So if you look that up on the internet, you'll find that, and you can download it as a booklet as well.
Absolutely brilliant. A pleasure as always, Anton. Really nice speaking to you. And I've certainly taken on board what you said, and I'm sure our listeners will as well. Cheers for talking to me.
Thank you, Chris.
Time now for your questions. I'm here with Chris Collins and Dr. Anton Rosenfeld. Hello, both.
Hi, Fiona.
Hello.
Right. So first one is a potato problem. Kate has grown potatoes successfully on her allotment for over 20 years, but since she switched to a veg patch in her back garden 4 years ago, she's not had very good results. She says the plants develop a healthy top growth, but then no potatoes underneath. And she has tried different varieties. They've all been the same. Other veg is fine. So what's going on with her potatoes? So any thoughts here, Anton?
Yeah, I think, well, that seems quite unusual, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen sort of people get poor crops of potatoes, but she's saying that she's hardly getting any at all. I mean, obviously, if you put loads of nitrogen on, then you'll get a lot of top growth, but not so much underneath. But to get no potatoes, I mean, to me, that suggests some really sort of serious nutrient imbalance. You know, something's gone really quite wrong somewhere. So, I'm slightly stumped on this, I must admit.
Yeah. So what would you suggest in terms of kind of really getting to the heart of the problem? You know, would it be a good idea if she perhaps did a soil test?
Yeah, I think that probably would be a good idea. So what I would suggest she does is she collects soil from the top 6 inches of the patch, takes samples from sort of at least 5 different bits and mixes it all up in a bucket, and then takes a smaller sample from that to send off. The price is only about £15-20, so it's not a huge amount. And from that, they will tell her the amounts of potassium, phosphorus, magnesium, the pH, the texture, and the organic matter levels in that soil. And yeah, basically she'll get some numbers back, but they also helpfully say whether that's high, low, or very high. And so she'll get an idea if something's really is out of whack there. I mean, it could be that it's quite low in potassium, but it could also be something that, for example, magnesium is really, really high, and that's can actually stop the plant taking up potassium. It could be that something's been added to the soil quite in the sort of fairly recent past, and that is what is causing the problem.
Okay. It is very strange, isn't it, if other vegetables are growing fine but potatoes not. Chris, have you got any suggestions of what she could do in the meantime?
Well, you know, you could still have a go at growing a Christmas crop. Because obviously Mary's pipe, but we all put those in for maybe get some for Christmas Day. So I would obviously revert to a container. So you can grow them in a container. So my advice would be, my favourite is a Hessian sack, basically. You can get one of them for £1. And then you get some decent pink-free compost. But what I'd do is I'd roll that sack down about 80%, put in my soil, put in my three set potato sets. And then as those potatoes start to grow, I'll add more soil, unroll the sack a bit, add more soil, unroll the sack a bit. So you're earthing up basically, but you're doing it in a container environment. And that means you get potatoes right through the sack, which will give you a good Christmas Day crop, hopefully. So as usual, there's always a way around it. Yeah. And I think containers is the go.
And even for a Christmas crop, you wouldn't need to bring that inside. You could do that outside.
Well, I think you'll be looking to tip them out. I think hopefully if you get the right conditions, they'll put on the growth and you'll get a crop for Christmas. So there is an element of risk to it, but I think it's probably worth a go, definitely.
Yeah, okay. All right. Quite interesting, though, that, you know, this has baffled us, this one. Last month on the podcast, we interviewed Juliet Sargent, who did talk about the importance of understanding what your soil is and what you've got. And she advocated doing soil tests. I mean, obviously you can get hold of soil tests quite easily, but you've gone one step further with this because you think this is quite serious, Anton, and you think actually it needs to be sent off for a proper analysis.
Yeah, I mean, you'll get somebody in a lab who will do a sort of proper test on it. I sometimes find that the soil tests home soil tests are okay for giving you a sort of full part figure, but I think it, in this case, it would be better to send it off. And it's not that expensive to do either. People assume that it's going to cost them a lot of money, but these places are geared up for testing farmers' soils who will regularly get their soils tested, and it doesn't cost too much, basically.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, good luck with that, Kate. Just let us know how you get on. Okay, on to rhubarb now. Question here from Graham, who says, I've read contradictory advice online about when to stop harvesting rhubarb and why, with some rather alarming information on the buildup of oxalic acid. Is there a consensus among experts? So, first question then is, when do you suggest stopping harvesting rhubarb, Chris?
Well, I think that your season really for rhubarb is early in the year. So and they'll fill a bit of a gap maybe when we're not waiting for other stuff to come through. That's when I prefer my rhubarb to be harvested. But so, yeah, spring and early summer is when I'll take my rhubarb. A little tip for you as well is they're quite hungry plants. So I tend to give them quite heavy organic fertilise in the late winter to give them a nice boost for the early spring. But what I'll do is I'll harvest my stems and I will do that spring, early summer, and then I will let them be. I will let them recover.
Yeah, very good. And they are brilliant because it's one of the first sort of fruits, isn't it?
Well, I'm just thinking crumble, Fiona.
So yeah. Any excuse, eh? Okay, so that's how to get a good crop. But is there any danger in just continuing to harvest it, Anton?
So the thing that he said is he's alarmed about the buildup of oxalic acid. So oxalic acid is it's present in a lot of plants, actually. You can taste it in chard, particularly in sorrel as well, that sort of tangy. Basically, small amounts of it aren't that bad for you, but a lot of it isn't good. Yeah. Most of it in rhubarb is actually in the leaves, and that, like we're all told to, don't eat the leaves. That's the main thing. There might be a little bit more oxalic acid later on in the season, but it's generally not amounts which are going to harm you. It's those leaves which are the things that need to avoid.
And actually, even harvesting later in the season, it's not so good anyway, is it?
It tends to be quite a lot bitter, doesn't it? If you're harvesting it later, I like that, especially if you cut the light out in that spring, you get that lovely soft stem, you know, whereas they tend to get more pithy as the season goes on.
Yeah,
it just gets tough, basically.
So on to our final question now, which is all about sand. And it's a question from Anissa, who's got a number of bags of builder's sand. And so she's wondering if it could be used on her clay soil to improve the drainage. Would we recommend this? First of all, Chris, there's a number of different types of sand, aren't there? So what would you or would you not use when it comes to using sand in your garden?
Well, I certainly wouldn't use builders because it tends to be what you call crushed sand. So basically they crush it and it's almost like tiny pieces of glass. And what happens is they then lock together in the soil and can form pans and impede drainage. You could be making the problem a lot worse, really.
Right.
So a lot of landscapers might lay on a sharp sand bed. So basically what you can do with that is it means you can get a very level surface. If you put it down in amounts for a lawn, so you can then level it off and put the lawn straight down. And that's quite feasible. For me personally, I would go to a lawn specialist and buy groundsman sand, top dressing as we'd call it. And that'll be round washed and round, and then that beds into the soil and helps with drainage. That could be for a lawn, or it could be for if you were growing veg, say. Most veg needs free draining soil as well. If it's really heavy, I would then probably put if we're having trouble draining, I would put in gravel slits. So you put every sort of meter square, you put a slit in about 2 centimeters diameter, 30 centimeters deep, and put horticultural gravel in, and that just breaks the pan up underneath and allows the drainage to come through. But definitely building sand, I think that's for mortar, for laying your bricks or laying your patios.
Okay, so the three that you said were okay to use were sharp sand, groundsman's sand, and horticultural grit.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, okay. From a kind of organic perspective, Anton, what's your feelings about builder's sand?
Well, like Chris said, we wouldn't use builder's sand at all just because it's not suitable for horticulture. It's also often got other impurities in it as well. So often it's got salt or it might have lime in it. You just don't know what it's not been basically destined for use in horticulture, so it really could damage your plants. So there are alternatives we could use to sand as well. We could, obviously, adding organic matter will help to improve the drainage of a clay soil. Also, my favourite, growing green manures as well. Particularly if you've got a pan, there are some green manures which have a really long, deep taproot, which can sort of break through the pan in the soil. The pan is a sort of hard layer in the soil. So things like alfalfa or chicory, they've got this really deep taproot, which will help to break it up and improve the drainage.
Okay, so it's not just sand. When it comes to trying to improve drainage, there are plenty of other ways to do it. Use of organic matter, use of green manures alongside sand if you need to, but make sure it's not builder's sand. Okay, all right. I think some quite concise answers there. Thank you very much, gentlemen. See you next time.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks so much to Anton and to Chris for joining me on the Organic Gardening Podcast. Do come back again next month when we've got a very exciting episode. We'll be talking to Chef Raymond Blanc, OBE, in his kitchen garden at Le Manoir aux Quatre Saisons Hotel. All that's left for me to do now is to thank Kevin MacLeod for the music, and we'll see you next time.